Everyone, or good morning, good evening, depending on where you might be in the world. Welcome to this event at the London School of Economics, sponsored by the School of Public Policy. My name is Andres Velasco. I'm the Dean of the School of Public Policy, and we are delighted to welcome Vince Cable. Welcome is not quite right because he's a part of our institution as a visiting professor at the LSE. But nonetheless, we are delighted to be hosting Vince, who will be presenting his book. I'm happy to report this is not the first book that Vince has presented at the LSE in the course of this year. And it is not the last book that he will be presenting this year either. Of course, Sir Vince Cable is a former Member of Parliament from Twickenham. He's a former government minister, a former leader of the Liberal Democratic Party in the United Kingdom between 2017 and 2019. And today he will be presenting a book about the economists and the world leaders who've made a very big difference. And as an economist who'd like to change economics, and as the dean of a school that is devoted to training world leaders, I am particularly eager to hear what Vince Cable will have to say. We're also honored and privileged to have Vicky Price as the discussant and commentator on Vince's presentation. Vicky is the Chief Economic Advisor at the Center for Economics and Business Research, and she is a former joint head of the UK Government Economic Service. The rules of engagement are as follows. We will hand it over to Vince for a presentation that will last between 15 and 20 minutes so that he can tell us what the book is about and what the main messages of the book happen to be. Then we will hand it over to Vicky for a response that will be between 5 and 10 minutes in length. I may use my chair's privilege to ask a question or two. And then we will open it up to discussion and Q&A from the audience. And please use the relevant function in Zoom to put in your questions, identify yourself, tell us who you are, and we will try to ask and cover as many of those questions and comments as possible. So without further ado, Vince, let me turn it over to you. Thank you very much, everyone, and welcome to the School of Public Policy.
Well, thanks, Andres, for chairing, and thanks to the LSE for hosting the event. It's really appreciated. Essentially, what this book is about is, I would say, political economy in the old-fashioned sense. It's about the link between economic policy and practical politics. You know, there was a time, sort of classic economics, we'd never dream of separating the politics and the economics from Adam Smith to Marx. The two were interwoven. But, you know, we've got into the habit, I think, with modern economics of drawing a rigid line between positive economics, questions of what would happen, and normative economics, what should happen. And, you know, economics has tended to be about the former and politicians about the latter, but they're interwoven. And this question interested me as somebody who spent all of my professional life with one foot in politics and the other foot in economics. But the way I've pursued it is by looking at a group of figures, major political figures, different countries. The criteria is a bit arbitrary, but the main factor is that they're consequential. It's not a question of whether they're good or bad, or did good or bad economics, or were good or bad politicians, but that they were consequential. They made a big difference. But just to say a little bit about some of the characters that I looked at. I had 16, could have had more or less, but of the 16, only three were professional economists who tried to make their way in politics and tried to change economic policy from that direction. And I looked at them in some detail. There were a couple of others, but the three that interested me were Erhard, the former Chancellor of Germany, Balcerowicz, who carried through the big bang reforms in Poland, And Manmohan Singh, who was an economist who did major economic reforms in India. You could add Roosevelt and Trump, both of whom did economics courses, though they later claimed it made no difference and found them completely useless. But just to say a little bit about Earhart, which I think illustrates some wider points. I mean, this is somebody who made an enormous difference to the economic policy of post-war Germany. He was said to be, and with some justice, the father of the Weltwirtschaft, the big recovery, the Wirtschaft's Wunder, which occurred after the Second World War. And he was inspired by an economic philosophy that we don't hear very much about in the UK, but it was social market in a German sense, not in the sense that we use social market in this country. You know, it's not, nothing to do with Tony Blair, the midway between socialism and capitalism. The German social market was free market economics, a very rigorous kind, but with a powerful state, nothing to do with laissez-faire, a powerful state which imposes order, monetary and fiscal discipline, and ensures that there is competition. And that was his approach. And with great skill, he maneuvered himself into a position where he headed up the Christian Democratic Party, which he didn't believe in. He didn't believe in Christian democracy or the slightly woolly Catholic inspired approach to social reform, but he used the party to ram through his approach to economics, which helped Germany enormously in the post-war recovery. And it's had a legacy in what's called ordo-liberalism, the idea of economic liberalism with order, which has its legacy very much in terms of German macroeconomic policy to this day. Another of my three economists was Manmohan Singh in India, who's another fascinating character who did sort of Cambridge economics, his DPhil with Ian Little at Oxford, but his main schooling with Prebisch at the United Nations, and spent a professional life operating the Indian planning system as a civil servant and advisor, and then became a politician, a finance minister, then prime minister, trying to push through radical economic reforms in the very difficult political environment of India, and had remarkable success, actually, and certainly over a two-decade period helped to project India into the most rapid economic growth that it's had in its history, virtually double-digit growth comparable to or in excess of China. But I think also illustrated some of the problems you have when an economist goes into politics. He ultimately got stuck in the complex politics of India, was dragged down by the corruption of his government. He's an extremely honest, austere man, but he was the reputation for corruption, dragged down his government, and the reforms effectively ground to a halt. And the third case was Balcerowicz, which he was a Orthodox Marxist-Leninist in his economic upbringing, but went through the kind of reforms of new thinking which took place in Poland, read Hayek and Friedman, and was persuaded of the virtues of economic liberalism, and then put in charge of the Big Bang reforms after the fall of communism and followed it through. He was the most hated man in Poland, but managed to ensure that the reforms were carried through, and subsequently became a minor politician that has succeeded in straddling the two worlds in a basically a successful world. So that's my first point. There are some professional economists who have made it in politics and made transformations. I think the second group of people who in ways more significant were people who were contrarian, who actually made a lasting contribution to economic policy as a result of doing something that was the opposite of what they've been preaching all their lives. I think a good example was Peel in the UK, who was an orthodox, very, very reactionary conservative, they were called Tories in those days. Was a protectionist, very committed to preserving the system of tariffs and import controls, which was the British model until the 1840s, and in particular defending British farmers, landlords, against import competition from wheat, but then found himself in government with a changing political situation, a growing working class, the need for reform, working with Gladstone, one of his junior ministers, and then discovering that you couldn't just do things by half measures, and within a period of 2 years was effectively converted from a protectionist way of thinking to all-out free trade, abolished the Corn Laws, which has become the basis for British policy, external policy, pretty much to this day. It was a major revolutionary transformation, which was upending his own personal belief system. I think another interesting figure in that way was Bismarck, who was not interested in economics, was ostentatiously bored by the subject, but actually did several really major things, one of which was understanding how a customs union can be used to have trade creation, and using trade diversion, excluding countries that you didn't want, in this case Austria. He converted, he created the Zollverein, which of course ultimately in a new form became the basis of the European Union, which essentially was a customs union at its outset. But did two other things. He was, unlike Peel, he was a rabid free trader who had been in the German liberal tradition, but was persuaded fairly late in life that this was not sensible. He switched, did a big U-turn, became a protectionist, introduced import controls, which supported the German military-industrial complex, and was very influenced indirectly by the ideas of Friedrich List and people of that kind. And then I did another thing. He was rampantly reactionary. He was described by the Kaiser as the most reactionary member of a reactionary class. Hated socialists, hated labor unions, but nonetheless was persuaded that the best model for modern Germany was a welfare state, and he pioneered a system which had regulated labor markets, social insurance, and in a little gap in his reactionary armory, he invited Karl Marx to write for one of his newspapers. Marx perhaps rather honorably said, no, thank you. But the ability of people to think flexibly did an enormous amount, of course, to change the way in which he operated economic policy in Germany. Of course, it ultimately led to the First World War, which was a cul-de-sac, but his transformation was extraordinary. Another example was Lenin, who, of course, we all know as the father of the Soviet Union, the introduction of war communism, but towards the end of his life brought in the new economic policy, understanding that markets matter. And although he was succeeded by Stalin, who did the opposite, the new economic policy had a very powerful legacy. It was tried in perestroika, but didn't work. That crucially, a young Chinese student, Deng Xiaoping, happened to be in Moscow when Lenin's market-based policies were being tried. It left a lasting impression and were carried forward in the massive economic reforms which transformed China. And then my final illustration of this sort of rather contrarian approach was we think of Roosevelt, the father of the New Deal, as the author of Keynesian economics, but if that is true, it was with very great reluctance and very belatedly. The New Deal was a radical program, but it had nothing to do with Keynesian economics. It was very much about regulating labor markets, regulating business, policies of income distribution. He didn't believe in deficit financing, spoke strongly against it, denounced the Republicans as for being too lax in their spending and running deficits. And indeed, 5 years into his presidency, was actively imposing austerity, as we now call it. And it was really very late in the day that he was persuaded by American Keynesians, Hanson, Lachlan Curry and others, to change his position, that it was not coming out of his belief system. I think a third sort of category of cases, which is a little bit troubling, but I think needs to be said, is that I think we like to think of, particularly since the fall of the Soviet Union, in terms of liberal democracy, belief that liberal economics and politics tended to go together. But the experience tends to show that sometimes, you know, good economics grows out of the barrel of a gun. And some of my more interesting characters were people who forced through very radical economic policy changes from a position of dictatorial power, and were highly successful in doing it. I mean, one of my case studies was General Park in Korea, who was in many ways a fascinating man who, amongst other things, was initially a communist in the chaos after the Second World War, was going to be executed, saved his neck by ratting on his communist colleagues and becoming an anti-communist and coming to the head of the South Korean army, from which standpoint he launched a military coup, which led to military government, which he then used to push through the kind of modernization of Korea, which we now recognize as a highly developed country, economically and politically, but would not have happened had it not been for Park and his radical transformation. And probably the most important example of all was, of course, Deng Xiaoping, who was anything but a liberal, was a strong believer in retaining the power of the Communist Party, was the author of the Tiananmen Square massacre. He was the person who gave the say-so. But at the same time was both visionary and courageous in pushing through the economic reforms that have led to the transformation of modern China. So there's no sort of comfortable conclusion with some of these cases, but they're very important. I think a fourth point I'd make, and I'd hopefully draw things to a conclusion in a few moments, was that it's possible to have sustainable politics but unsustainable economics, you know, what I suppose we could call populism. And the one example that I dwell on, the case study, is General Perón and Peronism, which has been the feature of Argentina pretty much since the Second World War. And what was interesting is not just Perón, who was quite an interesting man in himself, and quite apart from his wife Evita, but the fact that there have been six Peronists, all of which have repeated the cycle pretty much that he instituted of very lax macroeconomic policy, sometimes starting with good intentions, but eventually giving way to large fiscal deficits, which are then monetized and lead to inflation, sometimes hyperinflation. And Argentina has done this over and over and over again, and is doing it again today. And so an important question is, how does this happen? I think in this particular case, there was a sort of an interesting amalgam of values, including, you know, Catholic approaches to social justice, you know, which have what has sustained its value. And then finally, I think it's one of the things I tried to do in the book is to deal with the question which Keynes raised when he said that all practical men of affairs are slaves of some defunct economist. And you can trace, I think, in all the political figures that I look at, where they got their ideas from. You know, there was in the background, you know, an economic figure who they'd read and studied and absorbed or learnt about at second hand, which ultimately explained the way that they functioned. Alexander Hamilton, who I haven't talked about this afternoon, but was my first, is known primarily in popular terms for the, you know, the protection, infant industry protection and manufacturing, but actually his inspiration intellectually was Adam Smith, who he read, absorbed, and idealized. Peel didn't read economics as far as we know, but certainly was very much influenced at one removed by Ricardo and the thinking of economics which developed under him. And Bismarck was of no interest whatever in economics, but actually his mind was turned by a man called Cardoff, who was influential in Germany at the time, who in turn drew on the ideas of Friedrich List, which in turn came from Alexander Hamilton. And I think you can trace most of the interesting figures in that kind of way. And coming to the present day, you have Margaret Thatcher, who acknowledged her debt to Hayek and Friedman. Deng himself, who drew upon his experience with Lenin's economics, but also drew heavily on the Japanese experience from the 19th century and the Meiji dynasty. And I think an interesting detective story, and I think in all of these highly influential figures, is where did they get their ideas from? And there is a trail, and economics played a very important part in the way that these politicians, very important politicians, actually functioned. So perhaps I can leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vince. Not just a detective story, but an amazing set of stories. I have lots of questions, but I will keep them on the table until we've heard from Vicky. Vicky, without further ado, let me hand it over to you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for this, Vince. I have read the book and I think it's a great book and I've learned an awful lot from it, not least that Trump was an economist, something that I hadn't realized at all, although he claims really not to have much use for it. And he's not the only one, of course, who claims not to have much use of economists. Remember Michael Gove, of course, who said the same. But I think just taking some of the points that Vince raised, some of the people that he has tracked very extensively in the book were indeed, as he said, economists who also became politicians. One question one would have is, do economists actually make good politicians? Well, we looked at Trump. If he is an economist, he only survived for one term, so that doesn't sound too good. And some of the other examples given by Vince also say the same. But we have an experiment in Italy which has been tried twice. Yeah. We had Mario Monti, who became the technocratic head of Italy for a brief period during the Italian, Eurozone crisis, and did okay, in fact. And now we have Mario Draghi, another economist, who, of course, used to be head of the European Central Bank and can be credited with saving the euro. So, and he's managed actually very, very quickly to get agreement on the budget and to, if you like, sort out the crisis that Italy had just a few weeks ago. So this started just in the middle of February. So this is yet another experiment. So let's see how they do. Maybe you have to be Italian and called Mario to succeed as an economist who becomes a politician. So we should also change our names to that and our nationality too, if we can. But if you look at what has influenced quite a lot of the leaders that are described in this book, I mean, what way around is it? Do economists influence politicians, or is it politicians who pick and choose and bring in the economists or the economic theories that suit them, that they are relevant perhaps for the time and that perhaps help them either improve the situation and environment they're in or retain power? Of course, politicians have different needs and wishes, if you like, and different reasons why they get to power. And they may pick and choose, quite significantly. Again, I already mentioned Michael Gove. We got a bit of this with Brexit. Evidence was ignored, in my view. So it is possible to argue that good economics gets ignored at times in favor of bad economics if it suits one, or no economics at all, as we saw again, possibly in the Brexit debate. And there's always a danger, of course, when that happens. And it's interesting when you look at what's going on right now in the UK, when the government finally has to listen to the scientists, at least, and has realized that now we have to depend on data from here on. In other words, evidence, not dates. And the whole situation in relation to easing out is now data-driven rather than date-driven. So that at least suggests that one is listening to what people are telling them, but again, not always. And there have been some crucial areas when that has not been the case. So yes, Vince is right. Politics and economics were very much interlinked and still are, But somehow or other, some of the recent events have once again allowed for the two to get separated, with politicians' aims, if you like, taking precedence over what is happening to the economy. Of course, it can't last for very long, because then politicians fail. So that's how the cycle normally works. But I really liked Vince's quotes from Hamilton, because he did cover Hamilton quite extensively, and I found it fascinating, where he warns Hamilton against demagogic populism, which he says, or rather, as Vince says in the book, acquired a new relevance with President Trump, now, of course, gone. So again, it doesn't lead to good results. So I think this is a very good lesson from this particular narrative that we got from Vince in this book. And of course, you already mentioned Deng Xiaoping himself, who looked at how the new economic plan was working in Soviet Russia and then in the Soviet Union, and decided that that would work well in China, the present day China, with the very positive results for the economy, not necessarily for civil liberties that has followed. Now, of course, we look again at the list that Vince has chosen. Again, very interesting list, I have to say. Not all of them were prime ministers or heads of states. And he mentioned just now, of course, also Balcerowicz, who was finance and foreign minister in Poland more than once after the wall came down. And indeed, it's justified to have him there. He was the example of the short, sharp fall approach that was administered in Poland, which in the end worked well, but my God, what it caused in the meantime. And yes, of course, he moved to liberalize the economy. At the end, he really had very little choice, but he was a slow convert to it as well, because I remember very well when the wall came down, I was working in Eastern Europe as head of privatization for a big accounting firm. And one of the first jobs we did, of course, was in Poland. And Balcerowicz was there at the time, of course, as finance minister. And we did two reports, my first reports for Poland. One was on the sugar industry and one was on the fruit industry. But they were very heavy exporters of frozen strawberries, as I recall. So we looked at the fruit and vegetable area as well, and produced a report that suggested liberalizing, allowing, you know, foreign investment in, and all sorts of things, and things to do with prices. And Balcerowicz took our reports and waved them in Parliament and said, look at those reports. That firm, which I'm not going to mention now, is never going to work in Poland again. And it was the one job I did where I didn't get paid. So we had to write off all that cost. But we did indeed stay there. And also everything that was in the report was done, but with a break. So yes, of course, you can do reforms. But when you move so rapidly from one regime to another, you can make mistakes on the way. And of course, quite a lot of the whole vat of privatization that was done, particularly in places like Russia, has led to the rise of oligarchs, a complete distrust of the system. And I think quite a lot of Western economists can be, have their finger pointed at them as being architects of some of that, which of course has been a problem. So yes, economists, the IMF and so on, were listened to very extensively, and mistakes were made. And I think we're now suffering from some of that when we're looking at the way that Russia in particular has developed recently. Of course, you cover Vince Margaret Thatcher in one of your prime ministerial lists. And of course, it's very, very important. And she did choose a good advisor, in my view, in the shape of Alan Walters, who taught me at the LSE when I was doing my master's in monetary economics, and who, of course, was absolutely right about the ERM, about not joining the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, which eventually Margaret Thatcher did join, or rather, you know, she did join. And then John Major, in fact, got us out of it in the end, because it just didn't work a few years later. So we're talking a period of 89 to 92. Alan Walters was a good choice. You can't always make the right choices, but of course he created havoc politically. So we've got to bear that in mind too. And we have to realize that economists need to work very, very closely with politicians to get it to work right. So the final issue I will raise is that Margaret Thatcher is in fact the only woman in the 16, which is a bit of a shame. It's a reflection, of course, on women's lack of leadership, possibly. But, you know, we've fed Indira Gandhi, who actually got on very well with Margaret Thatcher. We've fed Golda Meir, of course. Both of them slightly controversial in some ways, but of course Golda Meir was involved in, you know, the time of a very important period for Israel. So perhaps the economics wasn't necessarily upfront in their minds when they were leaders, but it's interesting that there are no other women, and more importantly, that there isn't Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel's reign, I mean, she has been the head of government in Germany for 16 years, since 2005. She was shaped in Eastern Germany, actually, and in fact, the interesting thing is that she was a member of government, or rather as a deputy spokesperson in the first East German freely elected government that appeared after the wall came down. And of course, there was then reunification, of course, that happened. She was very involved after that in politics. And there's been this amazing transformation, of course, of Germany. Once again, now the biggest country in Europe. She's brought with it a bit of economic conservatism, there's no doubt about that. And she has, perhaps her background explains that. But also now, and I want to move now to my very final point on this, has moved from being very, very tight, you know, budgetary control person, which of course affected lots of countries during the Eurozone crisis very negatively, including the country I originally come from, which is Greece, to one which is all about spending more and also sharing risks and expanding and ensuring long-term sustainable growth. Who influenced that exactly, I don't know, but I think my conclusion is, looking at where we stand now, whether it's the Chinese who do it, the US, us, Germany, Japan, perhaps I mentioned Japan already, I don't know, it is that we have all become Keynesians at the end of the day. We may have different political systems. You see what's going on in China, of course. But nevertheless, in terms of the economics, we seem to have come to the conclusion that both Keynesianism, you know, spending, fiscal expansion to ensure there is growth after the crisis that we've just seen, and that continues for some time, backed by very substantial monetary expansion, is the name of the game. We may all come to an end when the vaccines have their full effect, but it is quite interesting to see that whatever your politics are telling you, we seem to have come to the same economic conclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vicky. That last point, and of course the many points you made before, but especially that last one, I think is very good food for thought, and I'm sure we will return to that idea and lots of others in the course of the discussion. I'm going to allow myself one objection and two questions before we open it up. My objection is related to what Vicky said at the very beginning. As a card-carrying economist, Vince, I am going to object vigorously to the idea that Donald Trump is an economist. you know, we economists get pretty bad press as it is. We don't need Trump joining our ranks to worsen even further the kind of publicity we get. Google tells me that he did undergraduate economics, which would not necessarily qualify him as an economist. He has an MBA, which in addition would not necessarily be the kind of thing we attach to a professional economist. So let us put him in some other category. I'm not sure what label should be attached to the other category, but certainly not an economist. Here are my questions. You describe the book, I'm looking at it right now, as a book about the world leaders who changed economics. And I suppose my first question is, what exactly do you have in mind when you are talking about changing economics? Because I could imagine, you know, the title stating that these leaders change economic policy, they change their countries, and sometimes, in some cases for the better, in some cases for the worst. But as I look at the list, there are not that many of them, it seems to me, who changed economics in the sense of doing things that became ideas or movements or policies that were replicated, that were imitated, and they became influential. I suppose in some cases you can have bad ideas which then become influential. I mean, Perón wrecked Argentina's economy, but he's certainly been copied, and not only in Latin America. But beyond that case, are we talking about politicians who influenced economic outcomes, or are we talking about politicians who influenced economics?
Well, to start with your objection, Andres, and I didn't ever say that Trump was an economist, but I did think it was important to look at what some people called Trumponomics, mm-hmm. which was a slightly pretentious little bit of labeling.
Right.
And it remains to be seen whether he was consequential. He may just evaporate into history. But a lot of people have attributed big changes in economic policy to him. Really two things, one of which is economic nationalism, which most of us would not regard as a force for good, but the reintroduction for the first time since the Second World War as tariffs and trade barriers and as an instrument of policy. I mean, that is fundamental. And if it sticks, which it looks as if it might, because the Democrats appear to endorse that aspect of his economic policy, he's been massively consequential. I say not for the good, but consequential. And of course, the second is which he brought forward from the Reagan era, which some people call plutopopulism, mm-hmm. which is the idea that you keep an economy going by tax cuts for the rich. You stimulate entrepreneurs by cutting their capital gains tax or their income tax. And he did that and claimed to have succeeded. I think many of us are highly skeptical. But it is a way of economic thinking, which is now quite embedded in the United States and has got emulators elsewhere. And if he leaves behind a legacy of economic nationalism and what we could call plutopopulism, he's been massively consequential. And so that was the basis on which I was looking at him, not that he was interesting in terms of economic theory. And I think you're right in a sense that that it's very difficult to think of political figures who have left behind interesting economic ideas, but they have been a vehicle for other people's economic ideas. I mean, if I just look for the moment at the Margaret Thatcher history. Fairly early on, one of the leading economists of my generation was Frank Hahn at Cambridge, who produced this dismissive quote that this woman has, produced nothing of any intellectual interest. And I thought, actually, that's the worst kind of comment from a professional economist, because, whether we like it or what she did or not, it was highly consequential. She took a body of economic ideas, sort of pure economic liberalism, sort of the macroeconomic policies, which, Friedman, which are taken forward by Aaron Walters and others, and, changed British economic policy. And had she not existed, it's difficult to think that Britain would be like it is today. So that's why she and other political figures are important, not because they were creative in the sense of creating a new body of economic thinking, but because they took ideas which were current and molded them and translated them into economic policy. And that's why I think many of these people are interesting.
They are indeed. Let me follow up with one other question on the connection between what politicians do and how lasting the impact of their ideas might be. Some of these are politicians in the Western democratic sense. Some of the men on your list, and the ones I'm thinking about, are all men, as Vicky pointed out, the list is mostly men. Some of these are outright dictators. Lenin is the most obvious example, but there are several others as I look at the list. Park in Korea, Deng in China, and others. Aside from the fact that ramming policies down people's throats is not necessarily the nicest thing to do, there is a second objection to the forceful imposition, or sometimes the violent imposition, of economic policies, namely that they don't last, or they last as long as the regime does. And even if you think some of these policies are good, they will be tainted by the way they came into being, and this might in fact make them less likely to last. I suppose in the case of China, growth has been so extraordinary that nobody's going to go back to small-scale agriculture when the current regime ends, whenever that might be. But as I think about dictators in my part of the world, many dictators in Latin America over the last quarter century imposed free market economics. I'm sure some people on this call like free market economics, others don't. But the main argument that is often made against free market economics in Latin America, for instance, is not that they're good or bad, is that they were imposed by force by a bunch of dictators. And as a result, who could possibly stick to those policies when they are the artifice of much, you know, suffering and repression and nasty behavior by men in uniform? So is there not a risk that these leaders change economics, but maybe in a way that would make those very policies both illegitimate and unsustainable?
Well, it can happen, and your continent is a very good example of dictators who came and went. But I would sort of question what you're saying. I mean, some of the biggest transformations have been achieved by a pretty nasty people in the political world, and they have stuck. That's why, in a way, one of my best examples was in Korea. I mean, Korea is now, we now cite it as a very good example of a multi-party democracy, and it's a mixed economy, and it works very well. But modern Korea would not exist had it not been for the forced industrialization and the massive capital formation that took place in the Park era. You know, he was in a way the founder of modern Korea, and one has to accept that. And he wasn't a communist, it was a totally different ideological mindset. Of course, he derived his ideas from partly from the Japanese 19th century history and applied them to the modern era, and partly also took the ideas from one of the leading American advisors at the time, who was Walt Rostow, who, of course, a lot of students know of through theories of economic growth. But, you know, he took those ideas and applied them in a very rather brutal way, and they stuck. I hesitate to say this because I know far you know far more about your own country than I do. I was tempted at one point to mention General Pinochet, but then I thought that would lose me my few remaining liberal friends if I entertained the idea. But of course, however horrific his rule, which was, you know, even a very unpleasant by Latin American dictatorial standards, it did, through the introduction of market economics, which was then carried forward by his, you know, social democratic successors, made a fundamental change in the way in which, you know, your country was run and functioned as relatively successful economy, now a member of the OECD. And in a way, a dictator, a very nasty one, had an important role to play in it. And although I'm not using this as an argument for dictatorship, I think one has to be reasonably objective about one's history and accepts that there are circumstances where fundamental changes are wrought in that kind of way.
No, I would certainly agree that the changes do come about. I think the question that follows then is, how persistent are they? And my point was simply that when they have that origin, in some countries at least, and in some circumstances, they may not be persistent because the policies, whether good or bad, are guilty by association with the very nasty guy who came up with a policy to begin with. But let me just ask one last thing before we open it up to Q&A. And let me say to the audience that we have a few questions, but we're certainly looking for more. So please There are 81 people on the call. Don't be shy. Please go ahead and upload your questions. But while people do that, Vince, if I may, one last question from me, and this is one in which I have a personal interest. You have at least three, maybe four professional economists who became politicians, and none of them did very well as a politician. I'm a professional economist who tried to run for office. I tried to become president of my country, and I lost the election. So I'm particularly keen to hear what you learned about why it is that economists who may be doing okay as ministers do so poorly as politicians. What should we learn? Give us a few tips.
Well, of the three I chose, one of them, Erhard, well, did become a very successful politician. He won election after election. But it was, one has to say, by being highly pragmatic to the point of cynicism, he jumped into the leadership of a party which he didn't believe in, but was likely to be more successful than the party he did believe in, which we now call the Free Democrats in Germany, the sort of liberal, economically liberal party. We did have one big success story. I think what in a way I was sort of groping at, that there are sorts of beliefs within the political world which are quite difficult to counter if you have an economic background, and that there is an issue around communication. Let me take one or two examples. I think the sort of instinctive belief is that, budgets have to balance, what used to be called pejoratively housewives economics. And of course, for people who get out of that and adopt a kind of Keynesianism, it's of course budgets never balance. I'll take another example. Exports are always good, imports are always bad. I mean, it's terrible economics, but it's deeply embedded in the belief system, or the idea that there's a sort of fixed amount of employment. It's fixed. You can't increase it, and you can destroy it, but you can't increase it. It's fixed. And I think part of the role of economists in politics is trying to grapple with some of these deeply embedded beliefs, and trying to communicate them in language which is not sort of economic jargon. And that is a real challenge. And, having spent my life doing politics and economics, just to take one example, at the start of my political career, I used to teach Adam Smith economics in the morning and then practice rent control in the afternoon as a socialist councillor in Glasgow. But at some point you've got to synthesize the two into some coherent system, and that's the real challenge.
Can I just add to that very, very quickly? Because of course I spent some time working for Vince in government, I have to say. But the interesting thing is that there are very few economists, in fact, who make it to finance ministers across the world. So they don't even get to that position, let alone become actually prime ministers. So there's an even bigger hurdle, from being an economist to being at the top when you haven't even probably been finance minister before. And you haven't been an economist while you were a finance minister, if you see what I mean. So there is a serious problem in terms of being able to use, as Vince is saying, the sort of your communication skills in such a way as to convey the population simple facts, but simple truths. So there isn't a fixed amount of labor. The lump of labor fallacy is a truism, I'm afraid. It is absolutely true that this is indeed the case. Now, how do you convey that to people who are losing their jobs and get substituted by others? You just don't, you find it very hard.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. Though I should emphasize that the phenomenon of economists not making it to finance ministers of their own country is particularly prevalent in North America and Western Europe. If you look around Asia, if you look around Africa, if you look around Latin America, almost all finance ministers are economists. Of course, most of those countries don't do very well in terms of economics, so maybe that says something about economists being finance ministers. Who knows? Let me move on now, if I may, to questions we're getting from our audience. And let me begin, we're always very proud at the LSE that we get a diverse audience on these events and book presentations. Let me begin with a question from Hattie Simpson, who is a GCSE student in London. Okay. And Hattie would like to know, of the 16 that you studied, Vince, first, who do you believe had the biggest effect on economics and why? And secondly, are there any other politicians that you considered including in the book, but at the last minute, did you leave them out and why?
Yes, that's a very good question. And I think if I had to pick out one, it would be Deng Xiaoping, because the transformation of China has, affected the lives of hundreds of millions of people. That's far from being trivial, and it's been sustained. It's a massive. So I think to some extent, he's in a league of his own. In terms of who I included or left out, the problem I struggled with was the European Union. After all, there was a lot of economic thinking went into the formation of the European Union. Shouldn't somebody be credited with that? But actually, the people who made it, I mean, people like Monnet, were not politicians. I mean, there was the occasional politician. Schuman had some political background in the pre-Gaullist era, but they were not politicians. They were sort of enlightened civil servants who took advantage of the structures that were developing after the war to make the economic union make it work. So it wasn't in many ways, it wasn't a political process, rather strange. But I did feel, as somebody who believes in the European project, that I'd somehow sold the pass by not including anybody from that background. So that was the serious omission. The last one I included, because I felt I had to, was I'm a social democrat, and I wanted to give an illustration of somebody who had made social democracy work, both the economics and the politics, which is quite a trick. And I chose Erlanda from Sweden, where they had this combination of open economy, freedom of trade, a market economy, but at the same time with a welfare state and a strong element of redistribution. And he and the Swedish Social Democrats, it's an interesting example about how economic thinking permeated politics. The Swedish School of Economics, which produced people like Ohlin, who economic students know from the Hexer-Ohlin theory and trade, was actually the leader of the opposition, but was a strong Keynesian in the wartime era, and his ideas were passed through. Gunnar Myrdal was another great Swedish economist, and these people's ideas fed their way into the political parties and helped to create a sort of coherent set of economic and political ideas, which they synthesized to create this very successful model of social democracy. Erlanda was the longest period as a prime minister and made it work.
Wonderful. Let me move on and maybe summarize and merge a few of the questions we're getting. There are several questions, unsurprisingly, that ask how come you didn't include so-and-so and so-and-so, questions of omission. And let me mention a few. Hassan Ghali, who's a former student at the School of Public Policy, wonders how come Erdogan from Turkey is not on the list. Hassan Ghali says, do you think Erdogan could be a world leader who actually changed the economics of his country? Andy Ross, who I presume is from the UK, says, yes, Deng Xiaoping was very influential, but didn't Clement Attlee from the UK deserve a mention? And while we're at it, could I ask you, Vince, to tell us a little bit about something that Vicky brought up? Wasn't Angela Merkel sort of an obvious candidate for this list? Not just because she's a woman, but also because she's governed the biggest country in Europe for so long and been, reasonably consistent and very successful in her economic approach. Or while we're thinking about social democratic Germans who brought in big reforms, perhaps Gerhard Schroeder might have been a candidate as well. Did you think about any of the above?
Yes, I did think about most of those. Not Erdogan in Turkey. I'm not sure what the modern Turkish economic model is. I mean, it's an interesting story from the pre-war era, and Atatürk's legacy, and you know, absorbing, you know, quite a different economic model. But of the two that I did think about, I mean, Attlee is certainly one. But I didn't, because it wasn't sustained. Of course, you know, post-war Britain changed governments in 1950-51, and the model that Attlee had established, it wasn't sustained. It returned, you know, 15 years later in a rather different form. But certainly, I, you know, would acknowledge the contribution that the post-war Labour government made to British recovery. But it's difficult to see that it had an enduring economic legacy and sort of modern laborism, you know, as carried through with Gordon Brown, who, you know, in many ways a very outstanding figure, was very different from the post-war. That's why I used Erlander rather than Attlee, because it was a secure structure that he established. And Angela Merkel, I take the rebuke about the lack of women, and my normal instincts would be to have proper balance here. I mean, Angela Merkel is a great character, a great achiever in the political world. But until very recently, it was very difficult to see any evidence that she had changed economic policy in a fundamental way. Vicky quite rightly says, within the very recent past, she's introduced this big switch in European fiscal policy that may or may not prove to be of enduring importance. So, yes, I think I would accept a mild rebuke from not looking at her. One category that I did look at, didn't include anybody, was anybody from sub-Saharan Africa, where quite a few professional economists have got into government. Mwai Kibaki, who I work for actually at one stage, was a very good economics student graduate. Became president of Kenya, but wasn't able to, or didn't feel inclined to introduce any significant improvements in economic policy that are noticeable. The one interesting case I should have looked at was Seretse Khama, who was the president of Botswana, which is in some ways the most successful model of development in Africa. And he understood in a way that very few people have done since, the so-called Dutch disease problem that natural resource economies have, and how to manage that in a sustainable way. So, yeah, there's a mission there. And I could go on, but I accept the rebuke. There are some good people and relevant people that I didn't look at.
Thank you. Well, we're on the subject of sub-Saharan Africa. Maybe Trevor Manuel, Mandela's finance minister, and the engineer of South Africa's then very successful economic policies, could have been a candidate. That would have been my personal favorite. Let me carry on here with some of the questions coming in through the chat. Simon Taylor asks a good question. He says, by the way, who was a bachelor in science and economics from the LSE. If you look at the 16, whose influence was due to luck and whose influence was due to good planning and able implementation? Can we make that distinction?
Yes, I think you can in part. And it's a good question. I think I probably need to refract a little bit. I mean, there were a few of my characters who came into government with a very clear program. You know, Margaret Thatcher's an obvious case, had a very clear set of beliefs, believed in market economics, not from an economist standpoint of economic efficiency, but as a faith, which he got from Hayek, the sort of freedom. But sometimes the figures I talked about achieved a great deal by accident. I think Peel is a good example, who was, as I said, a rather reactionary conservative in many ways. He's great achievement of Home Secretary was to reduce the number of cases for which you could be hung in Britain from about 400 offences without actually reducing the number of people who were hung. It was sort of administrative tidier-upper. But then faced with a real social and economic crisis in government, rising working class, growing unrest, famine in Ireland, stumbled on the need to take really radical action and actually did it. And in the process split his party for a very long period of time, but left a major legacy. But that was, I wouldn't say luck, but it was to some extent coincidence. So yes, there is that element of people who molded the circumstances in which they found themselves rather than created it. But, you know, most of them, I think, were more proactive. I mean, Earhart's a good example. Germany could have turned out very, very differently, but you had somebody with a vision, a very clear idea of what he wanted to do, and went out and did it. And that's more the model that I'm trying to describe in this book.
Wonderful. We've got more questions coming in. And Vicky, please feel free to jump in at any point. Where am I here? Yes. Joanna Turkin from Sciences Po in Paris would like to know about Earhart's lasting legacy, not only in Germany, but do you think, Vince, that legacy is also observable in the EU as a whole? I suppose, you know, that could be taken as an endorsement. The EU is fairly liberal, or that could be taken as a criticism. Some people would claim that the EU is not liberal enough. What is your take on that?
Yes, it was a legacy and a very major one. The belief, first of all, very strict market economics, strict competition policy, anti-cartel, was very much carried forward into the principles of the single market, which was, I suppose, British in some ways, but it's the same body of thinking. And also this sort of ordo-liberalism, which lies behind the fiscal policy, which until recently, as Vicky knows from her Greek experience, was very rigid. Merkel may have changed it, but it was in many ways the Earhart tradition, which left its mark on Europe. The irony is that he himself didn't really believe in European integration. He was a bit of a Eurosceptic. He was a contemporary, of course, of de Gaulle, and rather inclined to that idea of Europe of the nation states rather than the integrated Europe, and was very skeptical about the people who were trying to promote integration, close integration at his time. But yes, the legacy was long-lasting and a very powerful one.
I'm looking at the next question by Samantha Tozzi, who is a graduate of the LC, I believe. And she would like to know, of all these figures, and of more generally, of recent world figures over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, which one will future generations be reading about when they study political and economic history?
Well, Deng I've mentioned, and I think will be remembered in that way. And the other, who's we still remember 200 years after his work, was, of course, Hamilton, who was massively important and has helped to mold the institutions of the United States to this day. In several ways. I mean, first of all, the creation of a federal system, the division of revenues within a federal system, the division of debt. I mean, the recent change in the European Union reflect a kind of Hamilton type reform. Secondly, the creation of an independent monetary authority, which he in a way pioneered, the infant industry support for new technologies, which was something he did. It wasn't so much he did it, but the way he did it which was evidence-led policy, and something Vicky talked about at the very beginning. And this was somebody who, you know, 200 years before, you know, Michael Gove ditched experts, wanted to make a major policy change, thought about it, and thought the best way of doing it is to write, you know, 500 letters to different people around the world and to seek their views. You know, should America push hard to get into manufacturing industry, and how should it do it? And it was on the back of gathering evidence that he made his essentially his big letter on manufacturing and the policy that came out of it. So, but I think in terms of sort of methodology, as well as in terms of far-reaching economic policy changes, his memory will survive. What is remarkable is that we've only just rediscovered him. Very odd in a way, because he was, together with George Washington, probably the dominant of the founding fathers, but he always getting into scrapes and fights, and he had a particularly hate and loathing for Jefferson, who he detested as a slave owner, and eventually was killed, as we all know, in a duel. But his economic thinking has endured and will endure.
Well, I would just add that, of course, you know, it all depends if you're looking at 200 years, whether Hamilton the musical still goes on until then, assuming, of course, it starts again when the end of the restrictions, you know, come. But the other thing, of course, is that if we're thinking about, you know, the next century, who will think about China will have grown in importance. And the experiment there, which is a mix of whatever you want to call it, communism or certainly huge state control, capitalism, with, you know, is one that is probably going to be the most successful one in terms of world dominance, and a lot else will be perhaps, you know, forgotten or less important. But I'm sure that even they are in China are pinching the best ideas of all the leaders that we've just been talking about. There's one thing that I would like to add, which is that, you know, I talked about, we're all Keynesians now, of course, but what it seems to be happening is that, you know, it happens, of course, in China, but it's the increasing role of the state, and whether that remains now a new normal post-crisis, or whether that recedes. And that, of course, will very significantly pin the West against China, if you like, and possibly Russia, for the future. And that would be the interesting battle between economics and politics that we're going to be seeing.
Yes, well, one figure I hadn't talked about at all, but I think in ways is one of the most important contemporary politicians, who gave his name to something called Abenomics. Yes. Was the Prime Minister of Japan, who, as far as we know, had no particular interest in economic policy and was a background was a rather boring machine politician in the Conservative Party, the Liberal Democrats, as they're called in Japan. Mm-hmm. But unlike almost all other post-war Japanese politicians, stayed at the top for a decade, most of them last 18 months. And he stayed, and he supervised, whether he understood it or supported it, we're not totally clear, but oversaw some remarkable innovations in economic policy, which are almost certainly more advanced than anything that's taking place in Western Europe and North America, which was, first of all, the introduction of quantitative easing through reformers at the Japanese Central Bank, and then this very radical fiscal policy that if you're stuck in debt deflation, which is where much of the Western world has been, you get out of it by borrowing more. A very radical idea, which upset a lot of more conservative Japanese. But he oversaw that policy and has followed through, and has helped to ensure that although Japan is not exactly a booming economy, it's remained stable with rising living standards and full employment or near full employment.
Well, I suppose there are two ways of ensuring that your name lives on. One is you append omics to your surname. You spoke of Trumponomics. I'm not sure we'll be talking about that for a long time, but I suspect we will be talking about Abenomics for a while. And as Vicky pointed out, of course, of the 16 people on your list, the only one to have a wildly successful musical named after him is Alexander Hamilton. So I suspect that's one reason, aside from all the very sound economic policies that Hamilton proposed. While we will be talking about Hamilton for a very, very long time. Vicky, before we run out of time, from your home country, Greece, who should have made it to this list? Who was the most influential?
All right, well, I wouldn't necessarily have put a man politician on top, but of course we've had a series of dynasties, the Papandreou dynasty, the Karamanlis dynasty. But I would put a woman, if I could, Melina Mercouri, who of course made Greece so well known to everybody. Remember the city of culture, European city of culture, that's all her doing. And of course her unending attempts to get the Parthenon marbles back.
A noble cause indeed.
Absolutely. And a magnificent actress to boot. So, you know, quite a combination.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let me see. We've got a couple more questions here and maybe a couple more minutes, actually a bit more than a couple more minutes. Vanessa Rubio, who is a professor of practice at the School of Public Policy, says, extraordinary conversation, and then asks Vince, if all these 16 men and women, you had to pick one to be the current advisor to the G20 in the post-COVID world, who would you pick? Who's the one who's got the most to say about today's challenges?
Well, I just talked about Abe. I mean, I'm not sure that he was terribly clued up on economics, but he had his finance minister, a man called Aso, who certainly, I think, is one of the few Western leaders who, in a way, has been trying to think through the post-financial crisis economics and how you manage it. So probably having Japanese experience at the top table advising might well be the most useful. If I had to choose somebody, I would probably choose him. But in terms of course, development, and I think Vicky's right to keep reminding us that looking forward to this century, the dominant economies of the world are Asian. I mean, it's currently China and eventually will be India. It's that experience of large-scale transformation development, which is what we need not to lose sight of in terms of short-term macroeconomic management, and it's therefore the experience of the Korean, Deng, and Lee Kuan Yew, who I mentioned. You know, this idea of long-term stable policy making, having the advantages of openness, but also of intelligent government intervention, which was very much the hallmark of, you know, the Lee Kuan Yew style of government. So a leading Asian alongside, Abe, of course, also did. So it would be an Asian advisor, that combination.
So if it is Abe, we would get more deficits, more debt, and more QE, which might be just what the world needs right now. Who knows? Probably yes, at least from my humble point of view. Well, you just mentioned Lee Kuan Yew, and the next question I was going to read out also refers to Lee Kuan Yew. Question is from Yong O Ko, who is an MPA student here at the School of Public Policy, and says, Sir Vince, thank you for including President Park, who was as influential in Korea as Lee Kuan Yew was in Singapore. And then he has a very long question, which I'm going to summarize in the following way. How closely related do you think Park's achievements were to the fact that he was an authoritarian ruler? Or I suppose another way of asking the same question is, do you think he could have done what he did had he not been an authoritarian ruler?
I don't think so. I mean, there was some, it would have been very difficult to have taken the very long-term view that he took about industrialization in Korea had he not had that perspective. Things that have only just borne fruit, the launch of the Korean car industry, which was regarded at the time as completely mad, could only really have been done by a dictator who had minimal opposition and took a very long-term view about things. But just to go back a moment to Lee Kuan Yew, I've only just mentioned, but I think he's a particularly interesting figure who wasn't interested in economics as such. He was a lawyer, and he delegated his economic policy making to a colleague who actually had been at the LSE doing an MA in development studies, but created a model which has proved very durable, both politically and economically. And it's that combination of things that which sort of interests me in this project. And the politics was, how do you give people some choice, but keep long-term stability? And he's created this basically perpetual one-party state, but with a capacity for renewal. A very tricky exercise, but Singapore has had it. And I think the second thing is what we now accept as basic reality, the importance of state intervention, and doing it on a big scale, but doing it intelligently and recognizing how it has to be integrated with markets. You know, we have this caricature in the West of Singapore as a kind of laissez-faire paradise. Of course, nothing of the kind. It's a highly planned economy, but also open and competitive. And the way in which the Singaporeans devised the system of forced saving, which was as successful in its way as I think in any other country apart from Korea and Stalin's Russia, very high saving rates, forced savings, which were then channeled into productive investment, notably through public housing, and this circular process, which was overseen at one step removed by the state. I mean, this mixture of getting a stable political model and a form of economic development which uses the state and markets in tandem, that's, you know, in a way, the ultimate success story.
Vicky, please.
Could I just add, I hope you can hear me. Yeah?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. He said I was still muted for some reason. I mean, it's interesting because think about Germany again, this forced saving issue. I mean, it has been a solidarity fund that has been directed straight into East Germany for a very long period of time, which is actually similar. It did not require the willingness of the people to do it, to spend a certain amount of their money being directed there. It did not require a dictatorial regime necessarily to get there. So maybe it is the range of development you had in the country at that time that requires something different, but it doesn't mean you can't do it in democracies as well. But not forced, but certainly done for everybody, by everybody, but in a more accepted way than being forced to do it, if you see what I mean.
Actually, that's a very good point, which I was also entertaining in my head as Vince was speaking. If I think of my part of the world, you know, Pinochet gets credit with a lot of free market reforms done under a dictatorship, but it turns out a bunch of other countries in Latin America, I mean, Peru, of Colombia, of Mexico, did quite similar things in the following decade by much less bloody and more democratic means. So perhaps you can, maybe later, maybe more slowly, maybe more gradually, with ups and downs, but perhaps market reform is not simply the domain of guys with guns. I would like to think so, at least. Let me end with two questions that have to do with the US. One of our attendees would like to know, who do you think, Vince, Trump's main advisors or, you know, most influential economic advisors were, and will any of their ideas endure past his administration? And someone else is asking about Biden. I guess we don't know much exactly what Biden's legacy will be. We do know that he's going for a very large $1.9 trillion economic expansion. But again, should Biden leave a lasting legacy, what do you think it will be? Or perhaps what would you wish it to be, given that we're just at the very start of his government?
Well, Trump did have advisors, and some of them stayed the course. And they were really coming in from two directions. One was what you might call the Treasury view. Trump was obsessed by the stock exchange and the perception of him in financial markets. And so people like Larry Kudlow were, you know, retained their position and their influence. He was also influenced by people in what you might call the Laffer tradition, you know, this this idea that if you cut taxes, you raise more revenue, which, of course, may be true at a certain part in the supply curve, but doesn't apply as sort of overall good economics. But he was persuaded by that school of thinking, and it was very influential. But at the same time, he had this group of nativists who were strong nationalists who rejected globalization, were pathologically hostile to China. This is, in a way, the most influential and toxic legacy. In terms of the Biden administration, the one thing I would hope is that whereas, you know, there's a lot which Biden is doing and saying, which is, you know, to a foreigner, impressive and likable, and particularly his embrace of multilateralism and multilateral institutions and a rule-based system, which is great. But he has carried forward, you know, some of the protectionist instincts of his predecessor, the wish to return reasonably high tariffs, not just on China, but on the European Union and other countries. So what I would hope is that his administration is able quickly to work its way out of that mindset, which could do a lot of damage.
Can I just add, I agree with Vince about the tendencies of the Democrats also to be quite protectionist, but of course Biden will be remembered for having beaten Trump, of course. Yeah. You know, Trump is an example of, if we want to call him as an economist, he only survived one term. So this is a good example of economists not doing well, perhaps, or listening to the wrong advisors, who knows. But also, of course, in terms of what Biden does next, the most important influence, I think, is going to be Janet Yellen, who is now the Treasury Secretary. And of course, you know, she has gone through phases of being quite expansionist, and others, if you remember, while she was there, they started unwinding the QE, which had terrible consequences all across the world. I think that stopped pretty quickly afterwards. But I think right now she's in an expansionist mood, and I keep my fingers crossed that continues.
Absolutely. And who, unlike most of Trump economists, is a highly regarded, well-respected, very thoughtful and serious economist. Not sure you can say the same about most of the men, actually, in Trump's cabinet or Trump's team.
You said it, I didn't.
We are almost out of time. I'm also looking at my own computer and I'm about to run out of battery, so I would not want to crash before we end. Vince or Vicky, any parting thoughts in the minute or two we have left?
No, just to thank you for chairing the meeting. We ranged far and wide, which is probably the intention, but thank you for giving my book Money and Power an airing, and I hope people will actually read it.
Well, I'm delighted to be involved, I have to say. I enjoyed it hugely. And I think the questions raised all sorts of issues that were really worth dealing with now. Obviously, you know, a lot still unresolved in the world economy. We're just getting out of a crisis. Let's see what dominates in terms of thinking and economics in the future.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, both of you, Vicky. Again, not the first time, nor the last time we've had the privilege of having you join an LSE event. Hope we can do it again soon. And Vince, congratulations on a thought-provoking book and a wonderful, broad-ranging, thought-provoking discussion. This has been a lot of fun. On behalf of the LSE, on behalf of School of Public Policy, on behalf of the attendees from all over Britain and all over the world, thank you very, very much. And see you again soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.